It is Monday, December 26th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is the first of our very, very famous best ofs. The year 2022.
The most famous.
Let's bring Emma in on this as we talk about the best of 2022. The year it's beginning to wind down. I hope everybody had a what's that thing?
The pagan Christmas holiday.
Christmas, yes. Yeah. Happy. I hope everybody had a Merry Christmas. Of course, I think Hanukkah is still going on. It's in the future, but I believe it is still happening. I hope you had a Merry Christmas and that it was a white Christmas for you if you wanted, or there wasn't that much fighting.
Or a wet Christmas, so you're listening to this hungover. Right?
Yeah, I mean, drinking, yeah.
Could be okay. Fun, yeah.
I don't.
Don't judge people trying to get through the family time.
Oh, believe me. Back in the day when I would visit the in-laws and their Christmas celebrations, it was all measured by how much I could drink. But now I don't have such, and I probably worked out yesterday.
Nice.
Probably went to the gym.
Oh.
I don't belong to a gym. Folks, we have for you now, not just five, but actually six best of shows in a row for you. And what do we choose from this best of? Well, we choose, things that you nominated and that we chose, and then stuff that we just decided was best of. We're allowed to do that. They don't necessarily come from 2022. We allow, as you know, we have a fiscal best of year that runs from November to November. So we had some best of candidates in the past month that were just too close. So we're not going to do them. But this one, I think you can, this is not going to surprise anybody that I like this. We don't have any of the reconstruction so far on the list, but we're going to work on it. Maybe we'll see. The anti-oligarchy constitution. It was it's a book written by William Forbath and Joseph Fishkin, professors both. You'll hear their intros. But the thing that I found really interesting about it, and, you know, of course, it really doesn't matter what the assessment of the Constitution is these days because we have the Supreme Court as it is. But I'm quite convinced that when the founding fathers were talking about government to them at that time meant basically a king.
Mm-hmm.
And what is a king? A king is a single oligarch, a really rich dude who uses his money to essentially amass a private army to go out and collect taxes and to conquer other lands. Not unlike billionaires. Because, you know, you look at like what Bill Gates or Elon Musk are able to do. They just take their cash and they can change the entire, they basically rule a portion of our society. And their argument is that the Constitution is anti-oligarchic. And in part because it is a response to what, you know, these people were running away from. Oops, excuse me. We're running away from at that time, which was a basically an oligarch. It's called him a king. Mm. So it's a fascinating idea. And check it out, and people will enjoy it. How was your Christmas?
It was great.
Emma's not used to referring to the future in the past.
Yes, I'm not used to it now.
Speaking of future in the past, we also then have special bonus that we're doing. We're doing a little different this year. We're just doing like a freebie for everybody every day. Give you a sense of what we have on the fun half. Although these are Friday guests for the most part. John Hodgman and David Reese. John Hodgman, maybe you knew him from The Daily Show back in the day. Maybe you knew him as the IBM guy on the Mac commercials. I've had him on the program many times. He's a friend. David Reese, also a friend. He was the guy who did Get Your War On back in the early aughts and then went on to basically make a career for a while as someone who was an artisanal pencil sharpener. Can look that up.
Did you mean the PC guy?
Well, he was the PC guy in the Mac spots.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
not the IBM guy.
Did I say IBM?
Yeah.
That's all right.
All right.
Same thing.
Yeah, sure.
And so Reese and Hodgman have this great cartoon. I don't know if it got picked up again for another season. They won't know for a while, but I love it. I'm in a cartoon. I don't even watch cartoons, but this I could watch.
It was very funny the first season.
Right? And political too, right?
If I remember, it's been a while since it came out.
Yeah, but I think a second season came out. So folks, check it out.
I missed that.
All right. So enjoy these. Merry Christmas. This is our little Christmas present. And tomorrow we come back with a Hanukkah present for you. Make sure you tune in tomorrow. And don't forget, you can support this show by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. And go check out. We still got that sale happening with Sunset Lake, Sabade. They're doing a smokable promo. You don't need a promo code, although if you go over there and you use the promo code Left is Best, you still get the discount on everything else. But they're doing a 2-for-1. Get one free on the smokables. And that's that clicking you sound here is Matt clicking on his computer right now and doing that. So enjoy this. See you tomorrow. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program William Forbath. He is Associate Dean for Research at the University of Texas Austin Law School, and Joseph Fishkin, professor at the UCLA School of Law, authors of The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution, Reconstructing the Economic Foundations of Democracy. William and Joseph, Joey, and Willie, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, so let's start with just before we get into sort of the history of the changing perspective of the Constitution. Let's just start with where we are today, because in many respects, my sense is you have written this as a way of both acknowledging that a significant segment of our population, we'll call them left liberals, have lost a vision of a constitution that functions within the political economy, and that they must regain a specific vision. So William, why don't you tell us first where we are right now?
We're in a moment which commentators rightly often describe as a second Gilded Age. Mounting economic inequality, which more and more Americans see quite vividly, is also mounting political inequality. For the first time in a century, Americans are, or almost a century, talking about oligarchy, right? What's changed, however, is that Americans on the liberal and left side of the debate and conversation no longer have a clear sense of how their forebears, for most of our history, saw the crisis of economic and political inequality and the erosion of a middle class as a constitutional problem, not just a social or an economic problem, or not just a simple political one, but a problem for and about the Constitution. And so what we have is a situation where on the right, they never forgot the old way of seeing the world in which the Constitution had a lot to say about our economic life. And they never lost the idea that they should promote their vision through politics and in the courts. What we've lost on the left and liberal side are two big things: how we do constitutional politics and clashes and what they're about. On the left and liberal side, for good reasons, but now outdated, we fell in love with the courts. We fought the courts for most of the nation's history. The courts were not our friends, and they're not our friends today. But we still live in an important way in the sort of afterglow of the Warren Court. And so liberals and progressives made a dramatic and in many ways astonishing shift in mid-20th century America from fighting the court's account of the Constitution, to embracing the court against all critics. And we're very swiftly getting past that.
We're getting past it in terms of like our awareness that relationship.
Our awareness, but we're no longer, we've forgotten in the meantime,
right,
that it used to be that we fought about the Constitution. Everybody, the right, the left, the center, fought about the Constitution, not in judicial nomination hearings, but in ordinary party politics.
All right, and we will go back to that history, but before, and we will sort of go through that and when that was lost. But let me just ask you, Joey, in the sense that I think, you know, the conventional current contemporary vision of the Constitution is that it's a living document. And on some level, it feels like, despite the fact that someone like Breyer, for instance, very much associated with that idea, that the liberal left, to the extent that they believed in it, have not been practicing it that way. That it's the conservatives who have been both denying that it's a living document, but very much functioning as if it is.
Yes, the greatest practitioners, it's very ironic, the greatest practitioners of living constitutionalism in our time and the most successful ones have been conservatives whose whole mantra and political slogan is that they're originalists opposed to a living constitution. But what they knew is that political change can change the way courts interpret the Constitution, in part because you win presidencies and you win, you know, the right to appoint Supreme Court justices, and through that you can change the Constitution. The story of the relationship of the parties to the Constitution that Willie was outlining a minute ago is so important for liberals today to understand, because conservatives, really beginning with desegregation and sort of the aftermath of Brown, when candidates like Richard Nixon found that they could run on opposing what the court was doing and kind of build a political coalition around opposition to all the things that Warren Court was doing, from school prayer, which, you know, to busing to desegregate schools. And eventually by the late 70s, they added abortion. This centerpiece of conservative politics has enabled conservative majorities to change the meaning of the Constitution, to give us a Second Amendment that has become quite recently an individual right to bear arms, emerging from conservative movement through the Republican Party to the Supreme Court to our constitutional law. This is how our constitutional politics works and has always worked, but progressives and liberals haven't been engaged in it because we're still in this posture of telling courts, respect stare decisis, please don't backtrack on your old ruling so much. It's not a political body, the Supreme Court, please keep it separate from politics. These assumptions, these ways of thinking, which come out of liberal opposition to the right-wing opposition to the Warren Court, you know, but they no longer work because we have a very activist right-wing court today.
I want to go back, and then we'll catch back up to this point. But it's in my it is as if there is a whole cohort of the country, and really, you know, maybe that's exaggerated because I'm not sure, frankly, that the vast majority of the country has even a perspective on the court that is this way. But I'm thinking in terms of the legal institution And to the extent that everybody involved in the legal institution who is not in the Federalist Society, I guess is the way to say it, sort of believes in Santa Claus. It feels like on some level to me. And it's almost like you cannot wrench that idea that Santa Claus is not real or that the Easter Bunny is not real. And I'm curious as to how that develops. But let's go back to the sort of original perspective of the court that you outline. You walk us through sort of the best way to do it would be sort of the pre and post Civil War eras, because they're fundamentally different. But let's just start in the pre Civil War era, I guess, in the first 80 years of our country. William, what was the perspective of our founders in terms of like what role the court would play and how sort of sacrosanct it was? I say this as coming from multi-generations of attorneys. I'm not one myself, but, it was as if it was the priesthood. And did they look upon it at that time as being this sort of church, or was it a little bit more profane?
That's a great question. I think it may have been a church, but a much more modest church. In other words, the founders had in common a fairly high regard for a well-functioning judicial system. But oddly enough, the one thing they were very skeptical about, with a handful of the most conservatives, being exceptions like an Alexander Hamilton, but by and large, for them, constitutional law was just the opposite from ordinary law. So whereas they disagreed about the relative importance of federal versus state courts, but they all agreed courts had a lot of work to do. We didn't have a big administered state. Courts ran a lot of things. But the Constitution was thought to be, from a sort of long English tradition that ran, along parallel lines, a very special kind of law that embodied principles and rights that the people enforced against their rulers, the governed enforced against the government. And in England, this took the form of mobbing and petitioning and protest and convulsive politics, which then settled down, but always with the Constitution playing this, even though it wasn't a written constitution, it was a bundle of texts and ideas. And it played this special role, and the American revolutionaries embraced that and pushed it forward as their vision. So that the idea that the court had any role to play in enforcing the Constitution was already a dramatic departure, very controversial. In the early Republic in the 1780s, judges got impeached, right? At the state level, when they tried to enforce their state constitutions over against legislation they thought unconstitutional. So judicial review was the new kid on the block, even when Chief Justice Marshall, became the leader of the U.S. Supreme Court. And he slowly, brilliantly established the court's authority to have a part in interpreting and enforcing the Constitution. And then and you just interrupt me if I'm telling you too much.
No,
but and then gradually he pushed for the court not just having a role, but a premier role, and he did not succeed. He did not succeed. He uttered those words, but for the next century and more, it was always right a contest in which what we now call judicial supremacy was generally the loser. We get to what the Constitution was about and how economic life figured in it, that's an important background.
Well, because
judicial supremacy was never embraced until midway through the 20th century and that moment we talked about a moment ago.
And the absence of judicial supremacy means that what is supreme at that point is politics. And, yes. And so that battle is being waged there. So let's talk about, Joey, if we can, this concept of if the Constitution is a check on the power of the government, right? I mean, like fundamentally, that is, it is to the power of the government. Another way of saying the power of the government is, and particularly at that time, is the concentration of wealth and power, right? I mean, that's, I mean, it has to be, you don't have to protect the people from the government unless there is a concern that there is a concentration of wealth and power. So you could replace, on some level, it seems to me, that word government with the greatest amount of wealth and power. Maybe it's somebody wearing a crown. Maybe it's somebody who's amassed it in some other ways. And so the implication is that there should be some type of distribution of that power and of that wealth. And that was, in many respects, one of the prevailing ideas of what the Constitution meant.
Yeah, so from the early Republic on through, but especially when you get to the Jacksonian Revolution in politics, this idea that the Constitution gives us a reason and a set of arguments to block and to argue against legislating in ways that concentrate economic and political power. It becomes a through line. And you see that in most famously President Jackson's veto of the Bank of the United States, which, if you think back to what the country looked at that time, the wealth was concentrated in the Northeast in New York and in the cities, and all of these farmers in the hinterlands who voted for Jackson did not want the money to be concentrated in that way, and thought that things like this bank were going to just further this kind of oligarchic, wealthy, powerful concentration of power. Now, you mentioned at the beginning of this question the idea of the Constitution as a check against government. And that's exactly how President Jackson saw it in that veto, how I just described. But there was also emerging at the same time the beginnings of an idea that the Constitution actually requires things of government, that it's not just a limitation, but that the Constitution also puts in duties. This is what Jackson's opponents, the Whigs, thought, that the Constitution requires us to build a broad distribution of wealth, because it's a republic. You can't support a republic in a world of a few oligarchs and a lot of serfs. That's not a republic. And so if you're going to build that broad distribution of wealth, the two parties disagreed about how to do that. But this idea began to emerge, mostly on the Whig side, later to be adopted by the Republicans, that the Constitution imposed legislative duties on the federal government to build the kind of political economy and the kind of economic reforms and structures, whether that meant building the roads and the canals and all the infrastructure of the country, or whether that meant tariffs so that industry could develop in the country. There were constitutional duties that were imposed on Congress. Members of Congress were arguing on the floor of Congress that the Constitution requires us to do these things, because otherwise we won't have the kind of political economy that that our republic needs. And so that idea, too, which is very different from how a court-centered view of the Constitution today looks, this idea of a legislative constitutional duty also comes out of this same early period.
William, I talk about this is like the concept of egalitarian constitutionalism, and there are three commitments that are associated with that, and it seems to me that it's not necessarily at odds with that idea that the Constitution is also sort of a check on government, because it's really government just happened to be the only concentrated power and theoretically the only concentration of power in our society at that time, but it could be conceived of as being against all the idea of concentrated power. But tell us about the concepts of egalitarian constitutionalism.
So We need to rewind for just long enough for me to say that in this pre-Civil War era that we're about to sort of depart from to go forward, nobody smells like a rose, to put it mildly. We don't have heroes. Jackson ain't no hero from any sensible modern perspective. He, you know, his coalition rested on slaveholders and the sort of emerging, you know, smallholders, working people. He appealed at once to white plebeian guys who felt oppressed by the emerging new capitalist world around them, and to the planter class of the South, who for at least a time were invested in having a national party that welded together the interests of slaveholding planters on the one hand and sort of, you know, working, white working guys on the other. It was a tragedy that, you know, what was most visionary about and most militant in the terms of a broad distribution was a broad distribution for white guys that was understood by those white guys to rest on both, you know, women's subordination and black slavery and the exclusion of black people from the community, political community. And the Whigs, you know, were the ones who nurtured some of the, you know, early anti-slavery thinkers like Lincoln. And eventually the anti-slavery thinkers in both parties coalesced in a new formation, which was the Republican Party. And let's be clear as well that there was massive concentration of wealth in the South as well. That's whom the Republicans, when they became the nation's first sectional party, gave up the ghost of a Southern Republican Party until they defeated the South and were trying to build up a black base. But for the time being, they were the sectional party, and they said, we must, right, ultimately dismantle slavery. At first, they said, we'll honor it where it exists in the states. We must bar it from the territories, and we must put it on the road to extinction. And what we must also assail is what they thought of as the slave power or the planter oligarchy. Those were their words. This isn't just Joey and my saying, oh, there's a word that captures what's going on. This is a word and idea that we found, right, everywhere in the archives and literature of, you know, every period, including this period leading up to the Civil War and its aftermath.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but to be clear, part of the impetus, I mean, I think, you know, I think people certainly, and we've certainly talked about this on this program, that people are aware that the anti-slavery sentiment both could be, you know, it could be abolitionist and it could still be very much racist in many respects. Like, but you're saying that the that
either way, they were hostile to the planters and they wanted to abolish slavery.
As a function, at least in part, too, because they wanted to undermine the oligarchic nature of it.
Exactly.
It's the economic power of being able to own labor, essentially, that was also part of the impetus to get rid of slavery.
And they owned the Congress in a special way because they were overrepresented, right? The three-fifths clause, the notorious constitutional provision that gave, you know, the Southern delegation, right, representation by counting slaves, three-fifths of persons, even though, of course, they had no vote. So the South, it's no coincidence that so many of our pre-Civil War presidents were Southerners or from Virginia. That was the hub of both massive wealth and an overbearing political clout, thanks to, you know, some of what was baked into the Constitution. So the Civil War, and this takes us back to your question about what are the three principles, where do they come from? The Civil War Republicans and the Reconstruction Republicans grabbed this anti-oligarchy tradition, grabbed this broad middle class as a basis for a Republican government tradition. And for the first time, a major party said racial inclusion, bringing the black slaves into the citizenry, is another equally fundamental principle for a decent republic and a decent reading of the Constitution once we put these new amendments in it. And what we've forgotten is those amendments, in the eyes of these Republicans, did more than civil rights and political rights. They also, this takes us back to Joey's point, they also enjoined Congress, imposed a unduckable duty to redistribute land, to educate, to provide the sort of social and material bases of Black citizenship.
And just to remind people, this is when public schools were essentially adopted and promoted, and a lot of this stuff necessarily wasn't exactly executed in the way that I think a lot of the radical Republicans wanted. And there was a lot of negotiating that was unfortunate in the context of the 13th Amendment, let's say, that allowed for certain loopholes. And we see those loopholes, particularly in the context of voting, that come roaring back in what, you know, we call the Jim Crow era. But from a legal perspective, it also becomes sort of like the wind up, I guess, to the Lochner era, and as we are developing. So let's talk about that. And we should just say that those three precepts, just to be explicit about it, was to check on the concentrations of these trusts and these both economic and sort of political powers, to distribute the economic opportunities widely, and to extend that opportunity across both, you know, race and gender and other groups that were considered immigrants, I guess, on some level. And so we head into sort of almost like the Empire Strikes Back, I guess, era of the Lochner era. Joey, will you define what that means? Because this is a term that has come up on this program increasingly as we enter into a new Lochner era.
Yes.
Better to have a law professor put
it. Sure. Well, it's useful to bring some lawyers in, because one of the hallmarks of this political era that stretches around sort of the turn of the 20th century is the rise of the federal courts as an important player in political economy. So the story of this era, which we tell in a couple of chapters of the book, is one of massive economic transformation, right? This is the Industrial Revolution. You're having lots of workers in cities coming from the countryside. It's the rise of giant nation-spanning trusts, big corporations, the first great monopolies. And there's a populist and eventually progressive political movement on the other side saying these concentrations of power are too much. We need to tax this concentrated wealth. We need to create antitrust law to break up these companies that control, in some Western states, they control the whole state government, as in, you know, Montana, that we talk about in the book. And the idea was, you know, the kind of axis of political conflict in America is shifting on a variety of fronts to being this conflict between the concentrated new large corporate wealth oligarchs and the kind of populist rebellion against them and in favor of the people. This is the beginning of the labor movement in the United States, and labor organizing was widely crushed by not just, you know, employers and their often quasi-military efforts to crush unions, but also aided by the courts. The courts in this period were staffed largely by judges who came from the kind of new elite corporate bar, which was just emerging at this time. And so really for the first time, the courts become a very big player in the fights about political economy that we're interested in the book. And this prompts populists and progressives to question in various ways the courts' interpretations of the Constitution. Sometimes this takes the form of Article 5 constitutional amendments, right? So we have an amendment that says the court kind of very surprisingly decided that there couldn't be an income tax, and there was nationwide political organizing to put in an amendment, which we now have, the 16th Amendment, saying Congress has the power to do that. But there was also a broader political questioning of the authority of the courts and efforts to sort of, through statutes and through politics, to fight back against their vision of a kind of, this is to get back to your question, to get to their vision of a kind of contract and property rights are the highest rights constitution.
Let me ask you this, William. Was it, I mean, in retrospect, if you could have gone back and said, you know what, instead of pursuing a strategy of amending the Constitution to allow for an income tax, would it have been smarter at that time to simply say, no, you don't have the ability to limit the legislative the right to have an income tax is up to the government at that point. But by pushing for an amendment to the Constitution, there is almost a tacit acquiescence to the idea that it's not in the it's not the right of the legislature to do this, that it's somewhere in the Constitution that an income tax can exist, and giving too much authority to the court at that point.
It's a great question. And reform advocates argued both sides of just the question you put on the table. If we think that this interpretation of the Constitution's provisions about taxation, wherein the court forbids Congress from enacting an income tax, is both off the wall as a sort of legal and interpretive matter, and motivated by, you know, sheer class antagonism on the part of the justices, then maybe we should just push right back. Others saying, no, let's instead pursue an amendment in order to, as it were, put an exclamation point on the authority of Congress to do just this, which stood for a much broader vision of redistributing wealth. So that already when the court teed up the issue, the dissents in those cases, right, said this gets the Constitution upside down, that the Constitution requires, again, this takes us back to one of Joey and Mai's, you know, in some ways we see as one of the most important points in the book, a way of thinking about our constitutional contests around economic life and political economy as ones in which there are two sides, and the side that we're on doesn't simply say, no, Congress has the power to do this, but Congress must do this and the court must back off. And so even in the dissents, there was a consciousness that we've lost, that the, not just the anti-redistribution side, which is the Lochner side, which is the side that struck down the income tax, but the pro-redistribution side saw their, right, principles as constitutional ones, that our commitment to equal protection, our commitment to a Republican form of government, all required a new way of raising federal revenue, namely an income tax. So that it's quite a striking moment. And to come back to your question, I think no one on the side of the income tax amendment in the end thought they were legitimating the court. Right? They thought they were slapping down a court which had gone way too far and putting into the Constitution a commitment to a federal government that can tax wealth as much as it wants. Now, of course, that's going to be brought into question if progressives retake Congress and there's a wealth tax. You can count on, there are already many, right, old Lochner era style anti-redistributive constitutional arguments being mooted you know, in anticipation of a wealth tax, just as there are, you know, constitutional arguments being mooted about every element of the sort of broad progressive agenda.
And we should say the Lochner era, we just, you know, for the sake of people should know that the Lochner case was really about, I think it was in New York State, limiting work, the hours of people working. Like, I don't know if it was exactly a 40-hour work week at the time, but it was
60, but you're right. We should have put that out there. That Lochner itself was a labor case. All the great cases, so many of them, of the sort of Lochner era and then the New Deal era, revolved around sort of a sort of wage contract. Could state lawmakers and Congress rewrite the, you know, put a ceiling on the number of hours, put a floor on wages, empower workers to bargain collectively? These issues that, to some extent, we've almost forgotten our constitutional ones were at the heart of it.
And just for the sake of people who don't know, this was the court saying that there is a sacred right to the freedom of contract. But it also is ignoring at that point and saying that two parties can enter into contract. There should be no outside implications on that contract, like you can only work so many hours, or there's a minimum wage, or you have to be over, you know, the age of 12 or the age of, right. age of 14 or something to that right. effect. And we should say it overlooks the fact that somebody's enforcing that contract. And so that contract's not that free at the end of the day, because the government, of course, enforces it. And, you know, if you have and there's economic coercion and whatnot. So the there is no, it feels like, because this is going to be relevant when we start to talk about, you know, sort of what the prescriptive part of your book is. At that time, as FDR essentially, you know, has this big clash with the Supreme Court, and there isn't the same level of a tradition of reifying or deifying the court, so that asserting the we the people part of the Constitution is the most important part. And therefore, we, the people, via our elected representatives, can influence what the Constitution says, because that's the most important part. There wasn't a sort of like a culture to have to overcome at that point, was there?
It was just beginning, and it wasn't there yet. That's exactly right. There was the thing with the court that we think of today arises over the course of the 20th century. It arises through kind of parallel to the rise of the First Amendment, which you might think, if you were an originalist and didn't know a lot of history, you might think, well, of course, that we've had a First Amendment since the beginning, but it didn't do much in the first century and a bit of American life. The court starts enforcing it in the 20th century. And there's this moment, I think we ended up going very briefly over this in the book, but it was very interesting for me to learn this little bit of history that, you know, the idea of building the court up as this sort of central temple-like oracular interpreter of our Constitution. This was the project of some important lawyers and judges, including President and Chief Justice Taft, who's the guy who got the Supreme Court building built with its impressive marble facade, and how everyone could look at that and say, wow, you know, the Supreme Court, as opposed to it just meets in the basement of the Capitol, how it did before. And he was building up that court because he wanted to build up the Lochner Court. He wanted to build up the court that would stop progressive legislation and labor laws and all of those things from happening. But of course, by the time the building was finished, that court also was gone, and FDR had won these resounding popular victories running in part against the court. And so the court, you know, things got a little quiet until the court reemerged as the defender of civil liberties, and then eventually in the Warren Court era, civil rights. And so that story, how the court that was this image of a temple and of a, you know, we should respect the great authority of these nine sort of priests, to use your analogy from before, which I think is a very rich and important analogy. That was an attempt to build up the Lochner Court, but instead ended up building up the Warren Court in one of those sort of weird twists of history. And yes, at the time that FDR was fighting with the court, there was only the beginning. You know, you had the beginning. There were lawyers, the American Bar Association. There were sort of rumblings of we shouldn't have politicians pushing the court around, and that certainly was a challenge for FDR. But on the whole, the idea that the big questions of constitutional political economy get fought out in politics was, I think, still mostly the view.
And Roosevelt forthrightly put it on the table. There's a kind of pseudo-history of the court packing plan that doesn't really look at the sources, which says it was a sly and unpopular move that badly injured the New Deal ever after. And every one of those things is at best a half truth, you know, or not even that. Roosevelt, after a little bit of slyness saying, I need to replace the old judges, quickly got right and said to the people, let me lay it out. And again, in one fireside chat after another, just as he had during the campaign and his overwhelming victory. He said, two visions of the Constitution are clashing. Only one can prevail. Ours is one which says government must be the equal and government must govern over against the corporations that have miserably failed to pull us out of a depression. Government must govern and must enjoy, you know, power to regulate the national economy and redistribute wealth so that working people can buy the stuff they're making in the factories, or we'll never get out of the depression and we'll really lose our constitutional democracy to some kind of authoritarian regime. And when he won an overwhelming landslide, right, he and the New Dealers in Congress said that was a constitutional mandate to fight the court's kind of misreading of the Constitution. And then they had a debate a little bit like what you mentioned, Sam. And it's true. Some said, all right, we have an overwhelming majority. Let's amend the Constitution to make plain workers' rights, Congress's power, Congress's duties, redistribution, industrial government, and democracy. And Roosevelt said, we don't have the time. The amendment requirements will enable a small minority, just as they do today, to thwart amendments. And worse than that, the court's going to, you know, strain to read whatever we produce in the way of amendments according to its own reactionary lights. Let's go with my court packing plan. And then the court backed off. And headlines all across the country said, you know, the justices yield to, right, the combination of striking workers and a president who's called their bluff. And nobody, you know, and Roosevelt had a huge progressive majority who all agreed that the court had been, right, a kind of plutocratic outfit that was busting strikes and blowing up the New Deal, and good riddance. We, you know, would that we, you know, someday soon have that kind of majority. But at this point, everyone understands that the court is a player in a deep conflict over, you know, what kind of nation the Constitution promises.
There's so much paradox here, though, it seems to me, because on one hand, like I can just say as that I think the broad strokes of history, broad strokes, certainly the sort of it is more and it's changing over the past 5 or 10 years in my estimation, but it has been more of like a heterodox opinion that what FDR did was not out of the realm of civilization. You know, I'm trying to think of like I know I have interviewed people who have written about the failure of democracies, and the one thing they say was like, you know, what FDR did was wrong there. But in fact, what he was doing was actually part of a tradition that preexisted, and it was not anomalous. The problem is that on some level, liberals, civil rights advocates, sort of caught the car, as it were, and forgot why they were chasing it. And, you know, and created this entire sort of like edifice that the court is sacrosanct, to the extent that the entire legal institution, it seems to me, in 2000 was just like, how could they do this? So we're completely shocked. And who knows where things would have gone were it not for 9/11 following that ruling. But it seems to me like it is not hard to find people who are just appalled at what the court is doing, but still cannot bring themselves to the understanding that, like, this is a political institution subject to politics, because you can look at the Warren Court and you can look at the Roberts Court and something happened. And how you cannot get from the Warren Court, or frankly, the Lochner era, to the Warren Court, to the Roberts Court, unless it is influenced by politics. And it just seems that at one point there was a far more concerted effort on the right as we got into the early 70s. Like, they figured this out, that this is an explicit thing, and they went on a mission for it.
Yes. And I'll just add one little postscript that I think is revealing to the story that Willie was telling about the court packing plan itself. So part of why some of your guests and, you know, some people who you may hear take the view of the court packing plan that they do is because some of the very progressives who were part of FDR's effort to confront the court, they became, you know, after World War II, they became liberals. We had some research assistants track some individual members of Congress, you know, let's find the people. They kind of retconned their story of the court packing, but they went back and changed it so that actually in their new view, court packing had been a really bad idea, because now we're all about defending the court.
Right.
And why are we all about defending the court now? Because the Southern Manifesto is out there and huge swaths of the country are, you know, having signs up saying impeach Earl Warren because of Brown. And if we want desegregation to happen, we need to defend the court. That became the view of liberals. And as you say, conservatives then became the ones who understood and practiced the politics of judicial appointment much more ferociously for 60, 70 years. And the increasing accuracy of their choices after you start creating groups like the Federalist Society that translate the polarized nature of our politics into a place for law students and future judges to get trained and appointed. Now you have the kind of full results on display. And it's one of these strange things for law professors and people who study this. I mean, political scientists have been saying for a very long time, the court is political. Look at the appointments process, look at who appoints who and how the results come out differently. And, you know, law professors, I think, have been clinging more to a view that surely on most questions, it's still an apolitical court. That's now, I think, breaking down, and everyone is seeing that the political scientists were right.
Is it breaking down? I mean, I were it not for the 2000 election, I don't think I would be sitting here. I had a completely different career trajectory, and my relationship having had gone to law school for a year and coming from a family of lawyers and being told that it was an avocation and that the literally it felt like a priesthood, and to watch the sort of intense denial on behalf of the various people within the institution of the law that this is not political. I mean, I still will have arguments with my father, if you're watching this, Dad, sorry, where he is talking about the the judicial temperament or the qualities of the judge. And I'm like, this is not relevant anymore. This is, you know, I don't know that it ever was, but these concepts are, I can tell you how they're going to rule. And it doesn't matter whether you perceive them as learned or not. It's just going to be how clever they are when they get to that ruling. And are we at the precipice of like where people understand, at least within the institutions, because that's where it seems to me the grip has to be loosened before it becomes a question of politics.
I think there's some generational change on that front, but I'll let Willie take the
question. I think there's sort of, there's an impossible task and there's a plausible one. The impossible task is to depoliticize a court which has claimed for itself and to some extent been given power over so much of the sort of deeply contested basic issues, you know, on our political agenda, all the way, you know, not just political economy, which is what Joey and I are working on, but also obviously so many other, you know, important issues. They're a court that enjoys that much power over such a broad swath of constitutional and fundamental stuff is always going to be political. And the mistake of many of our fellow kind of liberals, not so much progressives any longer, but the mistake is to think that somehow by restoring, you can restore the sort of institutional legitimacy in the sense of a strong distinction between law and politics and a neutral seeming, more or less craft, like what your pa talks about, a judicious kind of court, when it has that much power. So I think by contrast, there is indispensable work that judges and courts do that can fairly be described as, you know, they can do it in a craftswoman-like way. They can do it in a way that shores up the difference between what it is to interpret and apply the law and what it is to make policy. There are going to be profound policy issues all laced through it, but it's going to be more, you know, defensible and more indispensable if it only had much less power. And the question is, how do you get that? And how much does that, I don't think court packing is a great idea either, quite honestly. I think there are probably better ways of curbing the court, but that may be for another day. Point is that the court needs, that Congress, right, needs to reclaim authority over much of those and own it. And that requires also parties and a progressive party that owns it. Right? And says, this is better for the court. This is like a little bit like FDR saying, I'm saving the court from itself. But how you do it is a tricky business.
Well, I mean, let's I started this interview by telling you that, you know, we're pre-recording this. And today, you know, we heard from a couple of different professors about the Fifth Circuit decision, which, you know, could very well be if the EPA case in front of the Supreme Court now doesn't do it. We could get the things like the non-delegation theory or principle or rule, depending on who you talk to, or reinstituted. And we could see the diminishment of the functioning of our government, you know, over the course of the next, 2, 3 years, 18 months, 5 years. What's the sequencing? I mean, court packing is just simply a tactic, and it seems to me it's a political one to say, this is me ringing the alarm. And Joe Biden has refused to do that. He had a commission that supposedly was looking at questions of reform, and it could not have been more anemic and less indicative of the problem that we're facing. What do we need to do? And is this something that you can do without any type of elected political power?
No, it's something that you could do through elected political power. I think the first thing to do is realign progressive and broader liberal democratic left, whatever politics, against the court. So that's where, you know, some of the work that you do and that you do by telling everyone about what's going on in the Fifth Circuit that otherwise would be, you know, the subject of only like lawyers knowing about it. matters, because the first thing we do is align politics in such a way that people understand that they should vote for Democrats who want to change some of the rules, who want to take some power away from the courts. Democrats who want to, you know, I mean, one of the very heartening signs so far for me this early, you know, election cycle is that you see a lot of Democratic candidates for Senate saying, "I'm for reforming the filibuster." You know, that's not a constitutional issue, but it's a very similar, you know, you need to have a Democratic party that is focused and aligned toward dealing with the problem of an out-of-control court, and that requires setting up a politics that is very unlike how politics has been for the last few years. I mean, if you look at the 2016 polls and you ask how important is the Supreme Court to your vote, among the people who said it was not at all important, you know, Hillary Clinton trounced Donald Trump among the not at all important group. So, you know, we got a lot of work to do.
And work on, forgive me, Joey.
Yeah, go ahead.
You just to sort of widen the lens without getting deep into, you know, the details, Congress can pass laws that take power away from the courts to do certain things to the administrative agency's decisions.
Including the
Congress
Supreme Court.
Congress controls the jurisdiction of the federal courts. The Constitution sets some limits, but there is a great deal of room within those limits for Congress to push back against a lot of these decisions, including, I don't think the non-delegation doctrine is right around the bend, but it could come back, and Congress will have to push back. And that will be a bitterly fought battle because you know, a great many portions of the you know, big business and small are perfectly happy with a radically diminished regulatory state. But it's a battle that the Dems can and should win. And it's a battle that Congress can do, not through court packing, but through sort of fine tuning the jurisdiction of the federal courts in various ways that will make a big difference. And if the court then overturns some of those measures on whatever kind of, you know, made up constitutional grounds, then take away the court's jurisdiction.
And the idea is to, I guess, heighten this contrast so that you begin to educate the public as to what's going on with these things. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling, mm-hmm. You know, in some respects, the issues that aren't necessarily or I mean, I shouldn't say that the question of Roe v. Wade doesn't affect the political economy. It does. I mean, I think everything does on some level, but it is certainly the threat to the regulatory state. And the administrative state, I think, is one that's going to get a lot less attention than right. something like a reversal of Roe v. Wade.
But reversing Roe, again, is bold congressional action.
Right. And it also...
I mean, not reversing Roe, reversing the
undoing. Reversal, Roe. Right.
Reinvigorating and reviving Roe, you know, will happen both at the state level and perhaps at the national level. But the broad strokes idea here is for lawmakers, state and federal, to embrace again their role as you know, as the sort of primo interpreters of the Constitution.
Well, it's a fascinating argument. It is not a moment too soon, sadly. William Forbath, Joseph Fishkin, the book is The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution, Reconstructing Economic Foundations of Democracy. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Maybe we'll have you back, sometime later this year to see how we're doing on that accord. It is, I think it really does articulate something that I think, you know, particularly the left in this country needs to understand, that relationship of the court within the political economy. And it is not enough to wish this institution away. It exists, and it needs to be seen as another lever and a just simply another political player that is on some level sensitive, albeit less sensitive than others, to political pressure. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us. This is great.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report with Emma Vigeland. Apparently our audio was hot on the stream. So people heard about all of that, that secret stuff we were talking about. Joining us, it is a pleasure to welcome both of these guys back to the show in one form or another, but never simultaneously, I don't think.
No, this is the first time.
This is the first time they've come together. David Rees, John Hodgman,
yes.
Each from their own individual acclaim, but now reunited for their second season of a show called Dicktown. And I will let me just preface this. By
hashtag Dicktown, hashtag Dicktown, hashtag FXX, 10 p.m. Thursday.
Okay, so
I'm a plug machine. I'm sorry.
I go to look for the show.
Yeah,
it's on Hulu.
Yeah.
And I'm told season two does not start until 4 a.m. last night or something. And so I don't watch it. But I'm thinking Dicktown, and on Hulu it says adult animation.
Yeah.
And I get a little confused. I'm going to be honest with you, because when I see adult animation, I have certain assumptions.
Especially with a name like Dicktown.
Why didn't you do it that way? Why wasn't it more dirty?
Why isn't it more erotic?
Yeah.
Erotic.
There's some erotic stuff later in the season.
I don't remember now.
You don't remember all the
no,
sexy
I'm
stuff
blushing. Again? Sam, I was the one who suggested this show should be called Dicktown. And I'm a very good boy. Yeah. I am the character that I play. John Hunchman is a weird only child grown up to be a weird only man. Does not swear very often. And that's true about me in life. And Dick isn't even a swear. I tell people it's old timey slang for detective, because it is a detective show. But yeah, I feel uncomfortable every time I say the name of the show, Dicktown. But
I'm not surprised by that at all.
Is what we called it.
And we should also say it's a nickname for the actual town that your two characters operate in.
Yeah, that was Richardsville, North Carolina. That was a retrofit. That was just trying to justify the dick and Dicktown.
I love that.
It makes a lot of sense. We have like three justifications for it. One, it's short for Richardsville. Dick is short for Richard. Town is short for Ville. Everybody knows that. Two, we play investigators solving mysteries for children, and private investigators used to be known as dicks, right? That's short for detectives, which is what we are. That's the second justification. Third justification, good, punchy name, great SEO. There's not much out there with that name. So that's good, too.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is that when you Google Dicktown, much to my surprise, it goes to our show. That's the first thing that comes up. I'm really excited about that. Now, I discovered that there was a subreddit called Dicktown on Reddit that was not about our show, but was instead dedicated to one person. I'm going to guess man's illustrations, cartoons of private parts. But it turns out that guy's a big fan of both David and me. So someone in that community, someone in that community said, hey, can we make this about the show Dicktown? And he's like, only if John Hodgman personally requests it. So what was I going to do? I wrote to the mayor of Dicktown and I said, please, can we make this a Dicktown subreddit? So if you want
to
find
the keys to your city,
give us the keys to your town. I mean, the truth is, may I be blunt?
Please.
This is a show about a former boy detective, Encyclopedia Brown style.
That's
boy
exactly
detective.
What I was going to say. This is Encyclopedia Brown.
Yeah.
All growed up.
For a while, I didn't want to say anything, but then I was like, yeah, let's have the Encyclopedia Brown estate come at us. That would be great. If they sued us, be great.
Best thing that could happen to you.
My character, John Hunchman, used to be a super smart, super sleuth when he was 15, 16, 17 years old. Solving mysteries for his little friends, the mystery of the stolen hockey cards, the mystery of the stolen club trophy or whatever. And David's character, David Purefoy, used to be my bully and arch nemesis. And if you know Encyclopedia Brown, Sam, and that sounds like you might, he was the Bugs Meanie to my Encyclopedia Brown. Bugs. Yeah. Oh, Emma, good. Thank you.
I was an Encyclopedia Brown encyclopedia as a child. I was very into it.
And then I'll drop further knowledge that at the end of season one, a new character is introduced, a person from our mutual past, Heather Culbreth, who was my Sally Kimball, my co-detective when we were young, except Heather got recruited by the FBI to go solve real crimes, whereas my character just grew up and never left Dicktown. And by the time of season one, he is pushing 40 and still solving mysteries for teenagers.
Well, that's the other part, is that it was like Encyclopedia Brown and that character that what's-his-face played in the Linkletter film and the school. What was this? Not School Days. What was that? The Linkletter film that
Dazed and Confused.
Yeah, Dazed and Confused.
Dazed and Confused. Yeah, Matthew McConaughey.
He's just hanging around with the high school kids. Yeah. And this is, I was going to say, like, look, people who watch this show know that I do not like animation. I just don't like. Right. I don't watch animated shows. I've never.
You think it's unholy?
No.
You think it's an affront against the bodies that the creator gave us.
As a kid, I watched Super Friends and Bugs Bunny and Scooby Doo, the whole thing. But when I got as an adult, I'm like, I miss the actors like performing this stuff. So I never watched I don't think I ever watched the full Simpsons. I never even watched it. Wow. I maybe watched one Bob's Burgers.
Oh,
so last night I tune in.
Good for Eugene.
Good for Eugene. I mean, it was one where I was on it, so I didn't.
Oh, okay, there you go.
I got to be clear. It was the Hugo episode where he's naked, and I sang during that. So that's why I watched that one.
Yeah, you got to sing it.
But last night I watched the most amount of contiguous animation I have ever watched in my entire life.
Wow!
Watch Rick and Morty. What's up?
No, it was your show. I loved it. I really honestly loved it.
Thanks,
it
Sam.
Wasn't
That's
until
amazing.
I got to episode 4 of season 1 where Benjamin came on and then things went south for me. I don't appreciate it.
Bad vibes.
I felt it was a little creepy. Like I didn't think he did a good job.
You understand.
He sort of brought the show
down. Let me just say, breaking news. We didn't want him. Obviously, we didn't want him.
It was so apparent.
There's a law that John Benjamin's got to be on every animated show. We can't break the law, Sam.
Honestly, I was like, I can tell what's happening here. It's FX. It was like an Archer thing. He probably was guaranteed in his contract to be on any show that FX was producing at the time.
No, it's really industry wide. Any cartoon has to offer a role to John Benjamin, and he turns them down.
Yeah, it was really, really uncomfortable. And then I had to, I watched that episode, but to watch 44 minutes and there's no commercials. So this was, Hulu sets them right up one after another.
Bing bong.
I gotta say, I really enjoyed the show.
Thank you.
The only thing I find curious is where does Reese, like, why, David, like, you're a bully? Like, that was a little hard for me to.
Oh, really?
Just the pushing, like, you don't come off as that physical, to be honest with you. Physically intimidating.
You don't think of me as a physical specimen? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying it was like a little bit. It was good that they, if it was not animated, it would have been tough to sell.
I see. I that character, you know, both of our characters are kind of exaggerated versions of ourselves. And in middle school and a little bit into high school, I was a bully.
Really?
I like to think I've grown out of it, but yeah, that's kind of, In fact, I've had conversations we worked this into the show later in that first season where I was at a bar or a dance party, and I ran into someone that I had gone to middle school with, and was like, "Oh, it's great to see you. We had so much fun in Miss So-and-so's civics class." And she was like, "What are you talking about? You were horrible to me. You bullied me nonstop about my Bon Jovi t-shirt. That wasn't fun. We weren't friends." And I was like, totally mortified. You know, it's like a awful thing to hear. Made a big impact on me, you know? And in fact, in this second season, in addition to the mystery of the week, we have an overall mystery that lasts the whole season, which is kind of about that, how two people can come away from something that happened in high school and have very different memories and very different interpretations of what it was. And one of those people, namely John's character, might not even remember what happened at all. So we try to deal with some of that stuff, you know, the kind of uncomfortable stuff about like, what, yeah, how do you reconcile being an adult with, you know, having been an asshole when you were a kid?
And but how did you do that in your personal life? How did you do that in your personal life? I mean, when did that change? People? Maybe I knew you after you had come to terms with what you got.
I think
much
so. Yeah. I tried. Yeah. You know, I was just, I wasn't beating, you know, I was in some fights, physical fights, but not a lot. And in fact, one time, we really going to get into this? Like one time in seventh grade, there was this girl who I used to really pick on, and she was taller than me. And after history class, seventh period, she was just sick of it. And she literally just body slammed me in the hallway. And it was like, I never picked on her again. You know, like everyone's always talking about Trump and Putin in terms of like, how do you stand up to a bully? What should we do? Should you try to placate them, or is there narcissism and family damage from generations of dysfunction just so profound that you can't reason with them? In my experience as a former bully, and I'm not saying we should establish a no-fly zone.
This is you,
like
and
that, but it's like, hang yeah, on, like breaking news. Me, like, it was over. She body breaking, slammed me.
Yeah, over. You and Lindsey Graham have the same approach.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Wow.
In fact, I would be so excited to be in a think tank with Lindsey Graham, and we could reach across the aisle. Like, we could make a lot of money that way, and we could go on C-SPAN.
Let me ask you this question. This is since we're talking about Lindsey Graham, if you were in a think tank with Lindsey Graham, or let's say here's your opportunity. You can go out to dinner with Lindsey Graham, and he will be given a truth serum, and he will have to answer any question truthfully. But you can never reveal what he tells you. Would you do it?
No, it'd be too much. My head would explode.
You wouldn't want to carry around.
I'm horrible at holding on to secrets. I cannot.
Because the secrets that he must have.
Oh my God.
And that dapper little head.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's only secrets he probably even keeps for himself. You know?
I respect a good haircut. Come on.
I mean, fine haircut.
It's a fine $2 haircut, South Carolina style.
I'd like to know exactly what he was. Wasn't he? He was pretty big, if I remember correctly, in the Clinton impeachment. I wonder what he was involved in, like when he would leave the Hill after one of his speeches about morality that he was so uptight about. But David, I got to say, you know, this. It's going to take me a while to get over the fact that you're picking on girls in seventh grade.
Does that feel early or late?
That seems a little late, doesn't it, John? I mean, John, you have kids.
It seems like maybe another option is don't do it at all. Doesn't mind.
No, I mean, like, I can see, like, you're in first grade and you're pulling somebody's pigtail.
Pull a pigtail.
Seventh grade, you're 13 years old, David.
No, I certainly wasn't pulling any pigtails.
On the other hand, you're only 13 years old. Think about that.
All right.
Judge really, John?
I can't defend my behavior. Yeah, it was a total, you know, I was a little.
You were a little stinker. Shit. You were a little stinker.
A little stinker.
You're a dick.
Yeah.
You're a dick.
I was a dick. Not to everybody, you know, and not all the time. And, you know, those types of things can be kind of fluid. Maybe you're nice to them one day and then the next day you turn on them or.
Doesn't sound like
picking
that.
On you so you deflect. I don't know. I mean, how do you guys survive without
it
bullying
it sounds
people?
Like that, but it doesn't sound like that's the way you were.
I was a dick in high school as well, but only through inaction, because I was like my character. I was a weird only child who didn't get a lot of outside time, who mostly sat around pretentiously reading books in my garret, dreaming about being a middle-aged man because I was so terrified of sexual adolescence, and I was a narcissist. So anyone who dealt with me, I had a very strong image of myself as a good person. And mostly I was a very capable student, well-liked by all my peers and teachers. I was not, even though I wore a fedora to school and carried a briefcase, I was amazingly not bullied.
Did you wear a fedora?
Of course I did. And I had long hair. And I had long hair.
That's right.
That's so much more offensive than bullying.
Brookline, Massachusetts.
I agree.
Well, I know. It was loathsome. I mean, I couldn't have been more semi-literally asking for it. But I ended up years later realizing that I had hurt people who I didn't pay enough attention to, who I thought were below me, who liked me, in one way or another, and I didn't even notice. And, you know, I think that that's the you know, when we talk about dicks and Dicktown, we're not talking too much about penises, if I am allowed to say that on a pod, on a radio, whatever this is, broadcast.
I had no idea.
No one knows anything anymore about what anything is. But we are talking a little bit about what it means to be a jerk and how to reckon with it. And that's what's happening. You know, David's character was a bully. My character ends up hiring him, since he's the only person I know in town. From that time, I end up hiring him as my driver and hired muscle. And we end up becoming friends because we're both working through the fact that we never properly grew up and we're stuck in this dick town, solving mysteries for teenagers and trying to figure out what you do to become a grown up. So, I called it Dick Town. I said Dick Town because one, there's a, there might be giant song called Can't Keep Johnny Down that has a lyric, all of the dicks in this dick town can't keep Johnny down. And I became fixated on that as an idea. And then I also realized that we are on FX or FXX. It has a reputation for being subversive and provocative and hold no punches. But as you can see through this conversation, we're a couple of emo dudes. The show has a lot of heart. You know what I mean? It's got a lot of heart.
I honestly am not a blowing smoke here. It is very rare that I watch any show, particularly their comedy, that I like anymore. Like I'm done. Like I can't. I just don't. Whatever it is, I don't
appreciate that.
And the show is very political. It's also got a lot of social critique, and it does have this really great relationship in the middle. I really genuinely liked it. Like I say, like I don't. I think it's the. I mean, I'm 55 years old. I think I watched the longest stretch of animated television I've watched in probably 40 years.
Incredible.
That means a lot.
I was super drunk. Super drunk. I couldn't.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I couldn't.
Living the dream.
I couldn't reach the remote.
55 years old, watching 44-minute blocks of comedy on Hulu with a drink in the middle of the night, waiting for season two to drop at 4 a.m. Woo! That's a big night for me, honestly, these days.
Your television.
But yeah, I mean, I appreciate that very much, Sam. And, you know, the show is about relationships and it's about stuff, you know, and I was afraid that FX was going to kind of look at our scripts and just cancel it for being too sincere. So we wanted to lean into the grown-up cartoon space by just calling it something a little gross, Dicktown, to provide us some cover.
Well, the high school thing too, having high school kids as like the clients.
Yeah.
It was also, I mean, I don't know how conscious you were of doing this, but it was also brilliant insofar as that it really gave an opportunity for some middle-aged guys. We're all middle-aged guys here. Feel safe in saying that.
Erasure right there. Wow. I
mean, well, Emma, not. I'm saying the
three of us, the three middle-aged guys here.
Two guys on the show.
Right.
Yes. I want to throw that around.
It's funny because the show is really about challenging the centrality of the middle-aged guys in this cartoon.
Yes, yes, and it comes off quite well in that respect. Not so much on this show. Sorry about that.
No, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the idea. Is like, you know, the kids, quote unquote, you know, they're all better in the show Dicktown. For, you know, not only did we get to work with some incredible actors who are younger than us, who come from different backgrounds than us, Ronald Pete as Tucker, who's sort of our Q, who provides us with all our gadgets, Obehi Janice, who's plays Heather, who becomes our pal, Anna Akana, who's this incredible musician and actor, who's kind of the biggest star of the show, but you don't know because it's, she's on Instagram and just destroying it there. You know, that was really great. But the best part was that all the teens, quote unquote, in the show are better at being grown-ups than we are, which I think is something that I've felt as a 50-year-old sort of dealing with the people who are in their 20s and 30s in my circle. In a lot of ways, I've often felt like, oh, you're better at being a grown-up than I am.
I feel that too, that this generation is just much more
prepared for like their the level of emotional intelligence
yeah.
of people at that age just seems to be significantly more than of our generation.
And the privileging of their own sort of happiness and life mission and tuning into what they want to do, because face it, they're in a world where they know very distinctly no one's going to help you. You are effed. All structures that were designed to help people who look like us of our generation are not helping them. So it's like, why wouldn't they become self-fulfilled people? Because there's nothing else. Like, you can't find meaning in a job.
Their first 20 years were so much more chaotic than ours were. I mean, on a national geopolitical level, you know, putting aside whatever individual circumstances they had, but like, you know, I mean, they had 9/11 and they had the Iraq war and they had like multiple crazy recessions. And then they have this knowledge of, you know, environmental collapse, and student loan debt is just completely different for that generation than it was for us. And then not to mention this worldwide pandemic where they realize like, oh, most people don't care if we live or die. Like, what? It's just like they're so much more battle hardened than we were, you know? It's insane.
It really is insane. I mean, Kurt Cobain died, and that was tough.
Right, right. I mean, we did have our burdens to carry, no doubt, but like, I don't know. When we had the Challenger, but the Challenger and 9/11 are just like on completely different scales, and they portend
not even
just completely different things.
Grenada, for a while, was touch and go.
Yeah, Falklands.
I don't know if you remember, that was also...
Oh, I have a question about this, actually. You guys would be the perfect people to ask this. Last night I went out with a high school friend of mine and we were sitting around talking kind of about this stuff. Like, what were the big events of our childhood? Why did we invade Panama?
Noriega was right. Selling drugs, I think, and not through our
accepted channels.
I mean, listen, I think, and at one point he threatened to like blow the whistle on George Herbert Walker Bush, who was a CIA director when Noriega was working for us. And I don't know how that worked out. I think
it was cocaine stuff, right?
I'm pretty sure.
Some and then type we of corruption. Blasted Guns N' Roses 24 hours a day outside his palace, right? To drive
Correct.
Him crazy? Yeah.
Yes.
And let me ask you this question, Sam. You're actually the perfect person to ask, as long as we're on this little tangent here. I hope this is okay. Forgive me. Sam, what was the name of the guy who made a name for himself back in the early 2000s, like when I was doing the cartoon? He was repurposing old World War II propaganda posters and making them about the war on terror. And they were very sarcastic and ironic. And he became famous because he told people he was a former Marine who had participated in an air raid in Panama. And then it turned out he made it all up.
I don't know who that is.
I don't know. I have no memory of this at all.
Micah something. Anyway, that was a Panama tangent.
Since this brain trust has failed, you're going to go to the internet now?
Yeah, I'll try the internet now for a second opinion.
Yeah.
I do remember a guy in, different guy, I think, but in Cambridge, like 10 years before that, 12 years before that, was putting up fake street signs with basically sort of situationist inspired slogans.
I know you were loving that. I was loving situationists.
Yeah, that was a fun time. But
Emma,
all that's gone.
They have fun. Village men, where they half remember things.
Yeah, that's a great podcast or broadcast or whatever this might be.
Poor Emma. This is just like going home for Thanksgiving and just like, oh, God.
What was the name of the guy who used to stand on the corner of Harvard Ave and wait for the bus?
Mr. Butch. No, that was Harvard Square.
That was the other thing that I really appreciated about the show, because I got to, I got through the first four episodes of season one, and one of them was about the party area up on like in the woods.
Party Pines, yeah.
We had that in Worcester, Newton Hill, where it was like people would go up back behind the school, and it was like in the woods, as it were, in Worcester, and there was keggers up there, and That's where people would party. And I sort of, it just made me think, like, if I went up there today, like, what would people be doing? Like, oh no, we turned it into like actually a little rec area. We've got ping pong. Right, yeah. And we've done,
yeah. And our show, the kids turn Party Pines into
say TED talk.
Yeah, they turn it into a TED talk.
Right.
Sorry, I talked over you there, Dave Reese.
Oh, Micah, I was Ian say, Wright.
Yes, that's it. That was
wow.
His name. That was
wait a
name.
Second, Matt. Is that really from Matt? No, that's from Matt's computer.
What
okay.
A pull.
Yeah. What?
Panama.
I didn't know that guy. I knew.
Micah, you're right. Micah,
you would recognize it. It went viral back in like 2001, 2002.
And by viral, that means it's stickers
exactly.
On lampposts.
People printed it up and put it on street
and
poles.
And handed it out to their friends. Yeah.
It was a wacky time because all these little invasions, Operation Just Cause or whatever Panama was called, Grenada, you know, we had just in the late 80s into the 90s, we had just come out of the shadow of the Cold War and the constant fear of nuclear annihilation. And we're getting back into it now. And it's a real nostalgia trip.
Yeah, like totally.
Late 80s and 90s was still a time where, like, you felt that the promises that were being made, at least to white men, were going to get kept.
Without a doubt.
And
the Fukuyama stuff.
Yeah, like the economic promises, the idea that if you, you know, work, you can make money. If you do, blah, 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 rent. Like, you know, my son, who is 16, is watching Friends all the time now. I'm not, like... He is absolutely fascinated with it. I think for him, it's like Game of Thrones. Like, this is a fantasy world in which people have large apartments and leisure time and a lot of sweater vests
and like careers as opposed to like everybody's working in marketing or driving Uber or something like that.
Yeah. They all have genuine careers, and the actor actually is a working actor. The masseuse is actually able to support herself in Manhattan,
right?
As a freelance masseuse, and that's her only gig. I mean, it's just such a fantasy. It's just, and of course, until Aisha comes on the show later on, zero cast members of color. It was just such a bizarre alternate universe that, you know, I have to tell them, no, that's what it was like. That's a little bit of what it was like if you were in a certain demographic bubble in New York City in the 90s, and you felt things will work out, and no one feels that now. And I can't, I don't prefer the past, honestly. I mean, what's going on now is terrible, but it's good that we're talking about how it doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah. For this audience in particular, I feel like, your show, the politics are right there. I mean, I think probably folks remember David, Get Your War On. Emma, do you remember, I feel like Emma was probably like,
well, you mentioned Kurt Cobain, you know, he died like 2 weeks before I was born. So,
Wow. There we go. Okay.
There we go.
Yep. So you don't remember watching Kurt Loder's announcement on MTV News in real time in the living room of your college housing?
In utero, I remember it. I mean, look
you
at
felt that. It. Yeah.
That was a Nirvana reference in.
I was gonna say that was the name of an album. I'm pretty sure.
See,
that's well done.
So Ben Shapiro calling Joe Biden the Kurt Cobain of politics didn't resonate with you?
You know, we did talk about it a bit. It did not.
Wait, did he say that?
Oh,
yeah, he did.
But it doesn't make any sense
because he's a monster.
Well, yeah, but it was just a reference to the suicide.
Right.
Joe Biden, the bane of politics, because he's putting the shotgun in the mouth of America and blowing his brains all over the wall, which would mean that he is both American
homicide.
Joe Biden, right?
A
rare misstep from Ben Shapiro.
a slight rhetorical slip up from a monster.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, let me ask you guys: is this on FXX too, or is it on Hulu? Or are they the same? What's the deal now?
Well, in these days of corporate synergy, sorry, you go FXX. Ahead and say it.
Every Thursday night in March at 10, there's new episodes. On FXX, the actual TV channel. And then the next day, those episodes are available on Hulu.
Interesting.
So at 4 a.m., apparently.
Yeah, if you don't have FXX, just stay up till 4 a.m., and then on Hulu, search Dicktown. You'll be able to see the latest season 2 episodes.
I'm glad that FX did that, because they were late. I mean, not to criticize FX, but, they were late. I couldn't watch FX shows if I didn't have cable for the longest time, but now they have the Hulu thing. Like, when The Americans was on, which is one of my favorite shows of all time, it was impossible to watch, and now they're finally, they figured it out, because it's easier with Hulu now.
Yeah, no, yeah,
there was
all,
something
it all
FX goes... Hulu Fox deal that changed a bunch of stuff, I think. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Anyway. Well, this is great stuff, but we should do a whole thing about the TV business.
Well, I have to say that we didn't know that there was going to get to be a season 2, and when we found out, we were really excited, but we were also terrified, because they told us almost exactly 1 year ago, we want a season 2, and we want it on the air as soon as possible. And so here it is just 1 year later, and that's very unusual for an animated show, to compress what had been for season 1 a 3-year timeline between writing scripts, recording, animating, noting, locking in music, recording or creating music. We did it all in 1 year. And to sit down and watch it last night on FXX, a television channel, just really blew my mind. First of all, I can't think of the last time I watched a television channel. And second of all, having it be on a television channel is weirdly meaningful to me. And I'm thrilled
back
that everyone...
television channels.
I know.
Go. I mean, it's on the television channel. It is the, as opposed to the streaming thing, right?
Well, it's on both FXX.
Yes, it is on both.
10 p.m.
Well, let me
on
ask
Thursday.
You about your production, because I know, with Bob's Burgers, we've been, and I haven't done too many during COVID, but it changed the production, the way we did the production. No longer in studio together.
Right.
How do you guys do it? Will you guys record your tracks together, or will you just record the lines separately, or what?
We got really lucky. We always like to record together in the same studio, be in the same space, because there's a lot of improvised dialogue and insults and stuff. And we were lucky over the course of the pandemic that whenever it was time to schedule a record session, at least for the two of us, it coincided with a dip in COVID, so I could always fly safely, and if we followed the protocols, we could be in the same studio. And we were also, once I was in New York,
you pod together,
we would bring in other cast members, but there was a lot of remote recording. There was.
Did it change the nature of the show, season 1, season 2?
I don't know if it was the recording particulars that changed. I think the biggest change was just the writing and kind of the ambition of it. I mean, there were definitely times when I wish we could have been in the same studio with the actor instead of sitting in our offices on our laptops directing them. It's just there's no comparison.
Yeah,
but, these people are troopers, and it was deep enough into the pandemic that I think a lot of people were used to it at that point,
yeah.
And also, there was no way that we would ever, there were people that we got that we wouldn't have gotten if not for how the whole industry had adjusted to the pandemic. So, Amy Sedaris is in a big story arc this season. Jamie Lee Curtis comes in to do a guest spot, and without being able to record remotely, I don't think they would have been able to do it. So we got lucky there. And, it was a weird transgressive thrill in late June or even earlier, like in April or May, when we started recording, and the case numbers were dropping, and people were being in places together again. And it was really moving for David to be able to fly here, and then we would go be in a room and breathe on each other. It was very exciting.
Hot breath of a close friend.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we probably recorded 17 hours that first day just breathing on each other. That's our process. Then we start to do the lines.
Then we add just the phonemes, and then we turn them into words and sentences.
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, I mean, it's good that you have that bank of all the breathing stuff, just in case you ever need to drop it in at different times, I would imagine. Yeah. Over the
well,
show.
We did get, also
the ADR.
We are also, because we are podcasters, we have pretty good microphones, respectively. David has Election Profit Makers podcast, and I have the Judge John Hodgman podcast. But what we couldn't do last season was what we did do this time. We were very nimble at the end. We could add lines and record them and send them into the studio, which we could not have done before. They wouldn't have accepted it. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was not high enough quality. But they have new tricks to make microphones like the one I'm using right now sound better. So we could adjust lines and add lines and do ADR from home or wherever we might be in ways that we couldn't have before.
What does ADR stand for?
Asynchronous dialogue.
Asynchronous. Recording. Okay.
Maybe it's additional. It might be additional. You're right, Sam, actually.
I like asynchronous. That sounds good.
I'm going to look it up.
It could be asynchronous, but I think it's additional.
That's it? That feels basic. Additional dialogue recording?
American Depository Receipt from Investopedia. It's a U.S. bank certificate representing shares in a foreign company for trade. So that's it. We're both wrong, apparently.
You know what? You know what it could stand for?
No.
American Dialogue Resetters. And that could be the name of me and Lindsey Graham's think tank, because we're going to reset the dialogue across America. We're going to change people's assumptions about what's possible.
Alternative dispute resolution. It's any procedure agreed to by the parties of dispute. But I like American Dialogue Resetters.
Well, I think that's a great place to end this. With the having settled on both the name of the think tank and the new meaning of the acronym ADR.
Whoa.
ADR.
Now masterclass.com is telling me automated dialogue replacement. Maybe no one knows what it really means.
Wow. It's just one
American
of those things.
American Dialogue Resetters.
.org.
Guys, I really love the show. Thank you so much
for
coming on.
I really appreciate that.
And would love to have you back on, just because it's a real pleasure to talk to both.
And anytime. I hope you know where to find me.
People can see it at any time. They don't have to stay up to 4 a.m. Let's just
no, they don't. It's the first episode is on Hulu now. The first two mysteries, I should say.
Oh, we should also say the first season is there, too.
The first season is all on Hulu. It's only 111 minutes long, the whole season.
Yeah, it's 11-minute bites. I mean, it's great.
We're not, it's a binge-let, I mean, honestly. So, I mean, it's about a quarter the length of an Avengers movie. So you can probably watch the first season.
I'm making my daughter watch the show, because she's just
good
watches. I want her to watch, stuff that's funny.
That's good dad stuff right there, I'll tell you what.
Well, and tell her we said thanks for watching.
Yeah, you can find it on your browser at bit.ly/dicktown, bit.ly/dicktown, or go to Hulu at any time at your convenience.
God, you're so savvy. So savvy. I know you came up with that bit.ly, and everybody was like, that's a great idea, John. Wow.
No, no one has ever – thank you, Sam, because no one has ever said it's a great idea. Most people –
well, you and I are on the same page when it comes to URLs. I mean, personally, I would have just bought cdicktown.com. instead of the bit.ly, but we're almost there.
Yeah, wonder who owns that one. Oh, contact Sam Cedar. Wow. All
exactly,
right.
Exactly. I did that to Benjamin, actually. For Benjamin's John Benjamin Has a Van. I bought up all the URLs.
You cyber squatted all those URLs
just to fuck with him. It was awesome. He had to
it's
come
fun
to
being
me.
A middle aged man.
Yeah, it was fun.
I know, right?
Yep, that was it. That was the highlight.
Emma,
that
you know better than anyone.
The past 20 years, just have him come to me like, give me the website. Well,
that's
maybe.
Incredible.
Emma knows guys, better than anyone so how great it is to be a middle-aged man.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Take it easy. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot
Shifted in and out.